The author Ronald Wright once argued that humans living in the information age are running 21st century software on 50,000-year-old hardware, which is to say, our brains. The software got a huge upgrade in 2007 with the arrival of the iPhone. The iPad followed 3 years later. Smartphones are at once miraculous and banal. They have thousands of times more computing power than NASA used to send astronauts to the moon. Smartphones have revolutionized our lives. What they're doing to our cranial hardware, though, is less clear. Well, aside from making us obsess over how many likes we get on social media or losing our ability to read for more than 5 minutes at a stretch, we're not really sure. That hasn't stopped us from putting smartphones into the hands of our children. In 2015, the Pew Research Center found that 75% of American teenagers either owned or had access to a smartphone. The average age at which kids in the U.S. become smartphone owners? 10 years old. Something that didn't even exist 11 years ago is now so essential to life in the modern world that few people, including kids, can imagine life without them. And that's the problem. One addiction expert in the UK likened giving a child a smartphone to, quote, giving them a gram of cocaine. Another body of research has linked smartphone use among young people to sleep disruption, loneliness, anxiety, depression, and even increased risk of suicide. Jean Twenge is professor of psychology at San Diego State University. She is the author of more than 130 scientific publications and 6 books. Her latest is iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. This morning she's in a studio in San Diego. Clive Thompson is a widely read Canadian technology journalist. He writes for the New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post, and Wired Magazine. He is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. And Clive Thompson joins us from our studio in New York. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Sunday edition.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
I'll start with Jean Twenge because the title of your book certainly underlines that this is a supercharged emotional issue. But I want to go to the last part of the title. It says, completely unprepared for adulthood. Is that all due to smartphones?
No, it's not. It's really part of a bigger cultural trend that got started around the late 1990s. So, for example, by the end of grade 12, about 17 or 18 years old, iGen teens are much less likely than their predecessors were to have a driver's license, to work at a job, to go out without their parents, to date, to have sex, and to drink alcohol. So these are all things that adults do and children don't that are milestones of adolescence. And you notice they're a mix of things that most parents would consider to be good trends,
right.
Some that are more neutral or a trade-off, like driving and working. But just seeing as good or bad, you miss the big picture, which is that teens, at least in terms of what they're doing, are growing up more slowly. They're taking longer to engage in these adult things. So the smartphone probably accelerated some of those trends because they do accelerate around 2010, right when smartphones started to become popular, probably because when you use a smartphone, it's not quite as necessary to go out of the house or to drive. But it doesn't explain all of the trends. Certainly, trends in working especially are not as likely to be connected to the smartphone.
The word that scares the hell out of parents, though, is this word addiction, that we say our children, teenagers, are addicted to smartphones. How does that happen? Why are they so much more vulnerable than adults?
Well, adults are very vulnerable as well. And the research that has looked at tech addiction has looked at both populations, at teens and adults. But teens certainly have their brain development isn't quite as far along in terms of their self-control. It is a developmental stage when they're just so concerned with fitting in and social status and popularity. So that phone becomes even more attractive under those circumstances.
Let me ask Clive Thompson now. I can remember back in the 50s when people got all worried about comic books. There were even congressional hearings about it, and radio, video games, all of that. I wonder if the doomsayers, I'm not suggesting the gene is, talking about a new technology, it's not new, is it? I mean, the argument about it is not new.
Well, it's definitely true that we historically are unsettled by communications tools. Like, things that change the way we relate to each other tend to unsettle us, and that goes back to the telephone and the telegraph. Mm-hmm. There's also, you know, a long history of being very, and I think, you know, appropriately concerned about young people. I mean, Betty Friedan, back in the Feminine Mystique, wrote at great length about the suburban mothers who were concerned about their kids were not independent because they were getting driven around everywhere. And Baden-Powell actually founded the Boy Scouts, partly because he was completely alarmed. He thought that the generation of young British men was far too effeminate. They weren't rugged. Yeah. You know, this whole Oscar Wildization of society, you know. So you always have to be a little careful that we olds, in which I include myself, age 49, are not being worried that kids are not growing up the way that we grew up. That said, I think, you know, like some of the stuff that Gene's documenting is true and real. And the fact that, you know, we have turned young people loose into this world where very large corporations, you know, Facebook and Twitter, are committed by marketplace dictates to trying to, you know, suck their users in and get them to stare at it as much as possible. I mean, that's their mission. There's definitely something there, right? You know, something.
Well, it's interesting because I'm wondering, has there ever been a single piece of technology that has so revolutionized the way we live so quickly?
Oh, boy. You know, maybe the automobile. I mean, the automobile really deformed and changed society. And it had a really catastrophic impact. I mean, back in the 1920s when they first came along, people were accustomed to walking on the roads. And they were just slaughtering hundreds and hundreds of people, including kids. And there was essentially a 20-year battle over who was going to run the roads. Was it going to be people or cars? And the cars won.
Yeah.
And we wound up, you know, completely deforming the world in a way that actually affects the stuff Gene's talking about, partly because we created a world where you can only get around by car. That's had implications for the independence of young kids today. I mean, Dana Boyd, who is a researcher with Data and Society, has done amazing. I mean, she's probably talked to more young people than anyone I know, well into the hundreds or thousands. And she consistently finds that kids would like to be able to have more of the freedom to be away from parental figures, authority figures. But the entire landscape they live in, particularly in exurban and suburban areas, has been architected so there is no physical space for them to be where there is not adult or authority figures nearby. They were driven out of malls, and the world around them doesn't even have parklets for them to hang out in.
Let me ask Gene then, if that's the case, you would think that something as addictive as smartphones would at least make children feel more connected, feel happier about themselves, their lives. But you say it's the opposite. It's making teenagers lonely, depressed, anxious, even suicidal. How does that happen?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Yeah, that's what some people have said for a while. Well, when teens are on social media or texting, or on their phones, they're communicating with their friends. That's
right.
What teens want to do. That's what they thrive on. Social media companies advertise themselves as a way for us to connect with each other. But when you look at the data, that doesn't really hold up. So for one thing, right at the time that smartphones became popular, when they gained market saturation, which was in 2012, that's exactly when loneliness among teens started to spike, symptoms of depression, suicide-related outcomes, suicide, happiness started to go down, life satisfaction started to go down, right at that time when they were spending a lot more time on their phones and a lot less time with each other in person. That's when mental health just kind of fell off a cliff.
Is it causal, though? That's, I guess,
right.
That's the question.
So that's the next question. So the time sequence lines up. The next question is, does this relate among individuals?
Yeah.
So in the research I was able to do, yes, there is a correlational link between, and many other researchers have found this as well, that teens and adults who spend more time on social media, on texting, on electronic devices in general, are more likely to be depressed and unhappy and have these suicide risk factors. But, of course, it's possible that, for example, people who are depressed then spend more time on social media. But for one thing, that doesn't explain the sudden spike in 2012. If that's the explanation, you know, depression leading to screen time, then you'd have to have, oh, okay, teen depression went up for some unknown reason, and that's why they started buying more smartphones. That makes no sense. There's also three other studies that have done a pretty good job of showing that that idea of depression causing screen time doesn't really work. There were two that followed people over time, found that people spent more time on social media, then were more unhappy. But when they were more unhappy, that didn't lead to more social media use. There was a third one. It was a true experiment, randomly assigned people to either give up Facebook for a week or not. Those who gave up Facebook ended the week less depressed, happier, and less lonely.
Is it possible, and this is highly speculative, that there are other factors involved? Adolescence has always been a very difficult time anyway. But is it possible that now teenagers are more open about being anxious or being depressed? They're willing to talk about it more than you and I did when we were in high school.
So if that was the case, for one thing, that doesn't explain the increase in the suicide rate. That's a behavior. That has nothing to do with admitting to problems. There's also similar trends in self-harm, so cutting, which is self-injurious behavior, which is related to suicide. That has also gone up, and hospitalizations for that have also gone up. So it doesn't explain those, and they follow exactly the same pattern. In addition, if it was teens being more willing to admit to problems, the pattern that you would expect is around, say, the 1990s, when there was more talk around mental health and it being more acceptable to talk about it, that the problems would start to rise around then and then just keep going. That is not what these data look like. They, at least for these measures in terms of depressive symptoms and suicide-related factors, they're either steady or they actually go down until about 2010, and then they go up. So it's not the pattern you'd expect if it was willingness to admit.
Clive, jump in here. Is it fair that the phones and social media and so on in particular are associated with all these negative mental health implications?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of a bunch of reasons just based on my own work why that would be the case. You know, one is that if you look at what all these tools are really doing, or one of the things that they do, is that they dramatically increase our awareness of the world around us, right? And so one
That's a good thing, isn't it?
I mean, like, what I was interested in my book was exploring what was the upside of that, right? You know, intellectually, that can be fantastic because you have many more avenues for understanding, you know, things that are going on, for making, you know, remote connections to things you're interested in. You know, disparate interest groups can form that could never have formed before because people are discover they're commonly interested in the same thing, whether that's, you know, model trains or you know, origami or democracy. So, you know, enhanced awareness is terrific intellectually. Now, enhanced awareness is not always terrific emotionally, particularly if you're a teenager. I mean, as Gene pointed out, this is a period in life when you're extremely concerned about where you are in the social pecking order, who you are as a person. And, you know, if you give teenagers tools for massively enhanced awareness of what everyone else is doing, you know, with a sort of a casino-like pull of the lever-like architecture that most of these social networks have, I can easily imagine that that would be a terrible thing. I mean, this is the ancient Greeks knew this, right? I mean, you know, Sophocles, you know, Oedipus Rex, you know, he has a great life as long as he's ignorant about what's really going on around him. The moment he starts to learn, everything goes to heck.
Gene, is it the act of watching screens that is deleterious or harmful, or is it the content of what these kids are watching?
You know, I actually think the main effect is neither one of those. I think the main effect is when teens spend so much time on screens. So by most surveys these days, between 6 to 8 hours a day of their leisure time is what it is around now. That crowds out time for things that are better for mental health, like spending time with your friends in person. And today's teens do that less. And sleeping. So sure enough, the percentage of teens who don't sleep enough also started to spike right around 2012. And not sleeping enough is a major risk factor for mood disorders like depression and suicide risk factors. So I think there is some direct effect of screens in terms of social comparison and seeing all the cool stuff that other people are doing. And especially for girls, a lot of the concerns around appearance and getting likes and followers. But that's only part of it. I think that the main effect is simply that when you're spending that much time on a screen, you're not spending as much time doing these things that are much better for mental health.
But doesn't it mean, isn't there a corollary here that you could infer from the time and the screens and all that, that the young people, teens, are more connected to each other and connected to people outside their immediate community?
Well, perhaps, but these relationships are more shallow. It's very similar to what Clive was saying about being more aware. Well, you might be more aware of what everybody is doing, but that doesn't mean that you feel a true, close, emotional connection with them that is crucial for mental health.
I mean, social media is really good at what, you know, Marshall Grinevitter would have called the weak ties, right? You know, like being able to sort of keep tabs on a larger collection of folks who are remotely connected to you. But, you know, you could easily imagine that comes at a cost to the, you know, what he would have called the strong ties, which is the very small number of people that, you know, that you rely on heavily, you know, in life, you know, your best friend, your family, whatnot. And on top of this, I mean, like this is, I mean, I'm going to go back to what Dana Boyd said to me, because I think this, what our research shows, because this really plays into it. There's been this architecting over the last 15-20 years of removing of spaces where kids can go. I mean, this is the thing she found, was that they were on their phones all the time, and it wasn't that they didn't want to hang out face-to-face with their friends, is that there was absolutely no way to do it, right? Like, they wanted the same thing that I had when I was a kid, which is a place where you're hanging out where there is no other parental authority around, where there's no adult
authority
around. You're on your own. Yeah, you're on your own. And so, you know, parents say, you know, tell your friends to come over to our house. They don't want to do that. They want autonomy. And so what Dana found over and over again when she talked to, you know, the hundreds of these kids was that social media for them was a poor replacement for an autonomous space where they could hang out with other kids. And I think for all the reasons Gene's pointing out, it's, you know, it doesn't satisfy the way that a face-to-face interaction would. But they were responding to, like, you know, all sorts of horrible things we adults started to put in place, partly driven by, you know, if you want to talk about, you want to talk about a technology that I think really wrecked things, you know, cable TV news, right? You know, because all these restrictions on kids' mobility started because of panic over, like, stranger danger and the endless loop of, you know, of statistically, you know, remote stories about bad things happening to young people that pretty much, you know, took over when CNN realized that you could make a lot of money by broadcasting nonstop for 24 hours about someone down a well.
I want to get at this question of isolation, though, because I hear this over and over again. People who are on the subway going to work, whatever, complaining that everybody has their head down looking at their phones and ignoring everyone around them and ignoring the world around them and so on. But we never complain when people have their head down reading a book. Why is that, do you think?
I think it's partially because books are not quite as addictive, and it's a little more possible to strike up a conversation with someone who's reading. I think it's also just that it's less common. I mean, if you look around in a public space now, say at an airport or on a train, and you see people looking down, it's a rare person who has a book. It's
everybody
almost everybody gets
right.
The phone.
Yep.
And it is true that historically, before you had screens, when books were used, when books, newspaper first were new, you know, we did complain about them sealing off other people. There's that, you know, like there's just a million New Yorker cartoons that show the father, you know, remote behind the newspaper, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And books themselves, when they came along, religious authorities were unbelievably unsettled by the novel and would write, you know, these endless pieces devoured by books and stuff like that. Now, this is not to dismiss the problems of sealing other people out with digital media, which I think is a real true thing today. I'm merely saying that, you know, whenever we've had a way to sort of shut other people off and we've seen it as a problem, we sort of reacted against it, you know, I think appropriately so.
That's Clive Thompson. He's a writer. He's a Canadian living in New York. He writes for the New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, and Wired Magazine. He's the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. He is in New York this morning. Jean Twenge is in San Diego. She's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University. Her new book is called iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. You're listening to the Sunday edition. Clive, we wouldn't say to a 16-year-old, for example, here's the keys to the car, go have fun. I mean, we'd teach them. we'd show them what to do.
No, precisely. I mean, like, one of the things that I think is a problem with modern technology, and you see this over and over again, in not just in social media, but in, like, say, like Google searching, right? Kids get turned loose in this stuff with basically no instruction in how to behave and how to comport themselves and how to critically assess what the tools are doing. So, you know, they do studies of Googling and they show that, you know, because basically no no educator has sat down and had the curriculum to say, here's how to disambiguate the good from the bad. You know, they just go with the top result, whether or not it's actually right. And so over and over again, you see that exact phenomena with social media. And it's kind of funny because, you know, I guess maybe we've sort of historically had this problem, but you can find these sometimes quaint attempts in the past to sort of help people figure out how to deal with curious new social media. Like in the 19th century, suddenly writing letters to people was this new way to communicate. And very unsettling to certain parents, because you could have two young lovers communicating with each other. There was a moral crusader in the 19th century who advocated that the only letters that should be allowed were postcards, because you should be able to see what anyone was writing one to another. To try and help people learn how to write a letter. You know, there was these books of sample letters and whatnot. They were sort of fumbling towards something that I think we should have right now, which is sort of almost like a civics, sort of how to use these spaces responsibly.
Gene, the smartphones have been around for a dozen years, 11 years now or something. Is it too early to draw conclusions about the effect these things have on teenage behavior? We're still in the experimental stage, aren't we? I mean, you have to go at these things over decades, do you not, in order to get some kind of hard data?
Well, sure. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions here.
Yeah.
There are some things that I think are pretty clear at this point. The link to mental health issues, especially with a high degree of use, the fall off in the in-person social interaction among teens. But there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I'm hoping in the coming years we'll try to figure out more about what effect this technology is having on the social skills of iGen, those who are growing up with the phone, spending their whole adolescence with the smartphone, to know what effect it's having on their attention span, to know what effect it's having on their cognitive development. Anecdotally, we're already seeing some signs of this. There are high school teachers who say, you know, my students won't look me in the eye. There's declines in SAT scores on the reading measure. There's tons of my fellow college faculty who say my students will not read the textbook. It's too long, and they won't even read a few pages in a row because they're so used to short bits of text. So we need more studies to find out, and hopefully those will be coming.
I'm wondering, have you ever thought that this might come down to teenage mimicry? Maybe children and teenagers are emulating us, the adults who spend their lives constantly on the computer or checking our phones, and they see what we're doing.
That's possible. I mean, I think there is a little bit of a difference, because for adults, it's often work. And for teens, you know, they do homework online, certainly, but more of what they're doing on their phones is more communicating with friends and entertainment. But as a general principle, these links that we're discussing between screen time and mental health appear for adults as well. So the idea that I always talk about, you know, limiting screen time to, say, 2 hours a day or less on phones and tablets, I think that is excellent advice for people of all ages, not just teenagers.
And the truth is, I mean, it's really funny, too. You look at all the tech leaders in Silicon Valley, and when they have kids themselves, and particularly when they have tweens and whatnot, they very often impose limits on how the kids use their stuff.
Well, Steve Jobs wouldn't let his kids have these things.
Sure, yeah. And I think it's Larry Page or Sergey Brin, one or the other founders of Google, was, you know, educated in the Waldorf schools, where they use technology in really, really, really later, right? So the people that are actually making the tools understand the need for moderation in how you use these things. And you think, well, if they've got that figured out, that should be more common knowledge. That should be more part of the curriculum, of the way we teach kids these days.
Okay, let me ask both of you then, how do we teach young people about screens? Gene, is it too late? Is the horse out of the barn to wean them off the addiction?
Well, I think there are definitely things that can be done. So yeah, I'm glad we're having these types of conversations to get the word out about this. I think we have to stop thinking of smartphones as completely harmless and just fun, and to set those limits. And I think those limits are reasonable. So setting that limit of basically not having that phone in your hand all the time.
Yep.
And what I sometimes say is using it as a tool and then it not being a tool that uses you. So trying to avoid that addiction and using it for what it's good for, all the wonderful things that that smartphone can do without getting to so many hours of use that it's crowding out time for other good things in life, or that it's, you know, affecting mental health. And I think that can definitely be done.
You have three daughters, right?
I do.
Do you set down rules governing use and time and all that? And if you do, what kind of battles do you have with your children?
So my kids are 11, 8, and 5.
Uh-huh.
So my oldest is in grade 5, and most of the kids in her class already have their own smartphone. She does not, and we're going to put off getting her a smartphone as long as possible. If we feel like she needs one next year when she goes to middle school, we might get her a flip phone or a Gizmo watch or something where she can just text us. Even that, we're not going to do right away. We'll put that off. But they do have tablets. My oldest has an iPad for school because her school provides them starting in third grade.
Really?
So that has actually been the bigger issue because, you know, of course they like to watch videos every once in a while on our iPads, and I'm fine with a limited amount of that, you know, half hour, 45 minutes a day, no big deal. But that school iPad is so tempting because she'll read a book on it because the school library is accessible through it. But then it's so tempting to go, and it has restrictions on it, but still she can look at the news feed. There's just, it's so easy to get sucked in.
Clive, you've got a couple of kids.
Yeah, almost 10 and almost 12, two boys.
Have you set down the commandments on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've, you know, again, because I've researched this stuff and, you know, they hear me doing interviews and talking to people. You know, we talk a lot, actually, about what's incredibly useful and powerful about these tools and what is seductive and hypnotic about them, basically. So we definitely set down rules. But for me, it's not just the rules. It's like it's the conversation also. You know, and I kind of talk to them about what their experiences are and what they like about them, what they don't like about them, what they observe about the way it affects the way they communicate and talk. Because I'm trying to get them to be critical consumers of this stuff so that when I'm not around, they also have their own mental and psychological and spiritual capacities to deal with them.
It's almost as if, Gene and Clive, that it's a problem for parents as well, very much so, because it's quite an emotional thing, as I said at the beginning. But the young people have the addictions and all of that and the attendant mental health problems. But the parents have a problem. We have a problem too, don't we?
Oh, my
God,
yeah.
You mean with our own use?
And the arguments with our children and what's enough time and too much time and all of that, the whole idea of their relationship to their smartphones creates, I would think, tensions and problems in the house.
Yeah, so there's one therapist who works with adolescents and their parents who says that parents today are digital pioneers.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, we're the first generation of parents who have had to deal with smartphones with teens and figure out what the limits are and are we going to put the app on this phone and when are we going to get our kid a phone? So it's true. We struggle with this every day.
Is the age getting younger for children using these? I mentioned 10 years old, but I've read stories where they're 4 and 5 year olds doing it.
Well, certainly tablets. There's plenty of video online of toddlers on iPads, and there are even strollers where you can mount a tablet.
No.
In the stroller.
Yes. No, really?
I've seen them. Yeah, I've seen them.
So walking down the street, the kid can play with the iPad in the stroller.
Yeah, which is especially distressing to me because that's the whole point of putting a kid in a stroller.
That's
is
right.
For them to see the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Let me ask you finally, both of you. Gene, I take it you're not optimistic about the future of this relationship with children and smartphones, that your concern overrides any kind of feelings that there might be an answer here.
Well, I think as long as we put limits, that this is a very good time to live. I mean, this technology has many, many benefits, just like everything. In moderation. And if we can find a good point for setting those limits, I am optimistic.
Clive, what about you?
I have the same view. I mean, I'm on record as being very appreciative of some of the gifts that enhanced communication has given to us. But I'm not just with my kids, with myself, frankly. I I put limits on the stuff. One of the things I think that actually is probably good for kids is for adults to sort of grapple with and understand and talk about, you know, our own relationship with these things, because that's part of how you model this stuff. Kids learn by looking at the behavior of the adults around them, the people that they love. So some of this begins at home.
As does everything. Thank you both. It's a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Take care now. Jean Twenge is professor of psychology at San Diego State University. Her new book is called iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. She was in a studio in San Diego, California. Clive Thompson writes for The New York Times, New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post, and Wired Magazine. He's the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. And he was in our studio in New York. You're listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius XM Radio. My name is Michael Enright.